Okay, we'll come to order. I'm not sure about the quorum, but we're awfully close. We're not going to vote today anyway. Actually, watering to order is probably appropriate for this group since we're talking about trying to contain health costs, and one of the great ideas is to drink water. We are about to embark on a very challenging mission here. This division has been charged with the opportunity, we call it that, Mr. Fran? The opportunity to work in the private sector to attempt to contain health care costs. That's almost an impossible task, I've been told, but that's what we're here for. And after we balance the budget, then this will look easy, maybe, by comparison. But I think the pressure is on us greatly to succeed. The people in this audience have been to most of the health meetings. They've been around longer than I have in many cases. And the pressure of rising costs in the system is no secret, and the challenges that that brings forward is not any surprise. As we listen to George Hoffman and others talk about the growing challenges in the public paid programs, it's apparent that the pressures in this system are, at least in some part, having an effect on who gets to find themselves enrolled in a state program because they couldn't find a way to be in a private one because the employer couldn't bear the costs or didn't offer new employees or the pay rate was too low or whatever numbers of reasons. And the rate of increase in costs in particular has been strangling every department that we attempt to fund, whether it be the environment or education, the general health care system, even transportation gets starved because the monies get shifted other ways. And so we have to succeed at this. And it's my desire to work in as broad-based, open-minded a way as possible, reaching across both the aisle and the street, and across to Hinckley and Hackensack and Bagley and Duluth and wherever else we can to get ideas from people about how to best address this. It's my desire that by the end of this session, we'll come up with a product out of this committee that the Senate will like, will pass the House well, the governor would sign, ways to promote that in at least a reasonable way. To keep my expectations realistic for all of you, the ideas that we'll listen to on the way to that point will be as large as this room. The final product will be the size of that table and as we try to find a consensus. It's my expectation as we move into the interim time, it will be an interim, I'm told. I hope there's an interim that starts May 24th and continues until next January or whenever. In the interim times, we can work in a continuing way in whatever format makes sense to continue the work. And I think it's a tall order, but I think we can handle it. In the Chinese symbol, if you remember, for crisis, has two symbols made up by it, danger and opportunity. I think that describes pretty well what we've got going here. and Hippocrates urged us all to above all do no harm. And it's my commitment as we go forward with our wonderful ideas that we do no harm to a system that's already hobbled in many ways by the well-intended efforts of the last couple decades. And as we do our work, we must preserve access, we must preserve quality while we constrain costs. And the people on this committee are not here as a choice of random selection. They're here because they're committed to the topic and they're willing to put in the time and they're bright and experienced. And I'm really looking forward to that. Today's work, maybe if Tom and Scott want to come to the lectern, there's not going to be a lot of time for discussion today until the end. What I wanted to help us get to was a good content time here where we can listen to Tom Tender and Scott Lights talk about the short version of where we've come to and where we are now. And we're then going to hear from the Department of Health and their evidence-based practices task force, and they're going to unveil their findings. We're then going to hear about some e-health, e-technology work, which some people see as being the magic answer, which I'm looking for a lot of miracle answers. We are fortunate to have the time today that's been freed up by the regular committee schedule. I don't foresee we'll be having that luxury very often, and I think we'll be meeting The best thing I could think of where some senators could actually come sometimes is, I think, Wednesday at 4:30. So we'll keep that in mind as we premeditate this. And members, I know you're busy on other committees, and I respect that. I promise we'll never take a vote without you knowing we're going to do something. The kind of work we'll come out of here with, if it doesn't get 8 votes out of the 11 of us, we can't take it out of this committee. So that's just my general thought, and I mean, maybe 7 is okay. But we can't be doing partisan votes, and 6-5s, even a bipartisan 6-5 isn't going to work for what I think we want to get to. So with that being said, I'll welcome Mr. Pender, and you can introduce yourself and tell us what notes you have for us, and thank you for coming to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Scott Leitz and I talked beforehand, and we decided that because he was bringing Julie Sonier with him up here, that I would just come up and speak first, and then the two of them would come so that we weren't crowded here. So that's how we decided to do this. And there's a little handout from me in your packets, just a brief outline of what I'm going to cover. This overview, I was asked to just give a brief overview of things that the legislature has enacted in the past in an attempt to control health care costs. And this deals only with the private sector, not with MA or Minnesota Care or State Health Plan or anything like that. And as I prepared for this and tried to decide what to talk about, I became more and more aware that the legislature has really succeeded in doing very little to control health care, that it's obviously a very difficult subject to deal with in spite of the legislature's having a strong incentive to control health care costs because it's a big part of the budget. Still, it's been something that's historically been very difficult. One thing that the legislature has done that I think is probably partly health care cost containment oriented is the hospital construction moratorium law. This was enacted in the late 1980s to replace what was called a certificate of need legislation, which was in effect before that. And there's a similar kind of history for nursing homes. And what the certificate of need legislation was a requirement that if you were going to add on to an existing hospital or build a new hospital, that you had to apply to the certificate to the commissioner of health and prove that there was a need for the additional capacity. And I think this was somewhat based on the sort of the concept that maybe supply creates its own demand, and that if you build hospital beds, they will come. And anyway, what the legislature did in the late 1980s was to repeal the certificate of need law and simply replace it with a moratorium, saying that there shall be no new hospital facilities constructed unless you're, you know, replacing existing beds or something like that. And so in order now to add beds to a hospital or build a new hospital, it's necessary to get a law passed exempting that particular facility from the moratorium law. And I counted this morning, there have been 18 exemptions enacted that are in law. So this law has Section A saying no new hospital beds, and then Paragraph B has a list of, you know, Paragraph A does not apply to, and then it mentions individual facilities. So that's a kind of a unique way of controlling health care costs. The next thing I want to cover is the Minnesota Care Acts that were enacted in the early to mid-90s, and some of you were here at that time and some of you weren't, and I'm going to just try to give you a flavor of what was involved in those acts, particularly relating to health care cost containment. I think the main feature of those laws that has stayed in place is the Minnesota Care Program and the 2% provider tax that funds it. But the Minnesota Care Acts were an attempt to both provide greater access and to control costs. And there was a link there, I think, in that the legislators who worked on this realized that if they could control costs, they could provide more access. And these laws were really, it was sort of a process where the legislators who were involved in this process of this legislation would decide what they wanted to do to control costs and enact something quite ambitious to do that, and but put in a delayed effective date to allow time to kind of figure out how to do it and how to implement it and so on. And then the next year, sometimes the effective date would be delayed again or it would be modified. And so it was a kind of a process of development over time. And it was really very comprehensive and bold in what it was trying to do. It was really trying to restructure the healthcare system. And just to give you a flavor of it, that bill would come to a committee to be dealt with, House research staff would bring in carts full of piled with amendments, and when these bills would come up on the floor, it would take 5 hours to deal with them. So it was just giving you this background for those of you who weren't here at that time. And just to give you a flavor of the cost containment things that were in this bill, there were requirements that everything be done through integrated service networks, which would be nonprofit integrated systems of providers and insurers, which would be providing care on either providers being salaried or on a capitated basis, where they would have an incentive to be efficient as far as costs went, because their payment would be based on a per-person amount regardless of how much was actually spent on them. And anybody that wasn't in one of these integrated service networks would be in what was called the regulated all-payer option, which was basically going to be a fee schedule kind of system for healthcare providers. These bills also involved these integrated service networks obviously were going to be strongly managed care-oriented. Then these involved a uniform standard benefit set, which would be, and there was a lot of discussion on whether you could have things in addition to the standard benefit set, but this was partly a cost containment kind of thing to specify what would be provided to people and what wouldn't. And there was also a component of this of global budgeting and growth limits, where the state would set budgets for the state healthcare budgets for the entire system, public and private, statewide, and broken down by region, and then broken down by individual care systems or integrated service networks. And there would be then growth limits on this, where if you were an integrated service network, you couldn't increase your expenditures by more than X percent per year, or you'd be penalized. And so anyway, I'm just trying to give you the flavor of that this was an attempt to really try to restructure the system. And it, I think, similar to the plan that Hillary Clinton was working on about 2 years behind us in Washington, it ran into a lot of difficulties and the kind of situation where when you change one thing, you have to change other things, and that causes you to need to change other things, and as you do that, things get more and more complex, and opposition gathers. One thing I want to mention from the Minnesota Care Acts that actually did go into effect and has survived is the small employer insurance market changes, and this was partly oriented toward increasing access to care by making the small employer market a friendlier place for small employers. It also involved some cost regulation. It required, for instance, prior approval of insurance premiums, and that's still in effect today in the small employer market for the most place. It involved increased loss ratios, meaning the percentage of premiums that insurers had to pay out as payment for health care, as opposed to administrative costs and other things that didn't involve directly paying out or providing health care benefits to people, and also involved rating bands, where premium rates were allowed to vary among employers, but within rating bands, so that premiums wouldn't be either too high or too low, but would be within a somewhat restricted band. So this was. I just wanted to give you the flavor of the Minnesota Care Acts as sort of an example of a really ambitious attempt to control health care costs, among other things. In the late 90s, we saw a period of stricter managed care being used, and this was largely a private sector initiative where the private market went in that direction as a way of controlling costs. And I'd say the legislature didn't particularly do anything to encourage that development or anything major to encourage that development, and did do things to moderate it control what some considered its successes. So, for instance, in the 1990s, we had a continuing increase in the number of mandated benefit laws passed in Minnesota to require that certain things be covered by health coverage plans. Also, we had in the late 90s several acts passed that were called Patient Protection Acts that were designed to outlaw certain managed care practices that were viewed as unfair to patients. And also there was provider contracting legislation to deal with the increasingly tough bargaining between the health plans and health care providers and outlaw certain practices that were viewed as unfair to providers. So I'd say in that context, the legislature didn't contribute to health care cost containment and acted to moderate private sector efforts to control costs would be one way of characterizing it. In the 1990s, we did have, I'm going to go on to deal with medical liability legislation now, which seems to be the term that's used instead of medical malpractice. In the 1990s, we had a couple of laws passed dealing with medical liability, and actually these were both in Minnesota Care Acts. One of them, which I think has been significant, is the requirement of an affidavit of expert review that when an attorney files files or begins a malpractice lawsuit in Minnesota, the attorney has to provide an affidavit signed by him or her saying that the attorney has consulted with a medical expert who'd be qualified to testify on the subject matter of the litigation. In other words, is an expert on what was involved in the alleged malpractice, and that expert has given an opinion that did appear to be malpractice involved there. So this is kind of requiring that people do at least some initial assessment of a lawsuit before they begin it. Another thing that the legislature did, and this is really unusual, is enacted a set of standard interrogatories in medical malpractice cases. And if you look in Chapter 604 of statutes, you'll see page after page of standard interrogatories that are available for use in medical malpractice cases. And it's my impression that hasn't been particularly a particularly significant factor, but it's certainly unique. Moving on to more recent legislation in general and healthcare cost containment, we had, I didn't include this in the outline, but in 2003 the legislature enacted a law dealing with adverse healthcare event reporting, requiring that if something happened in a healthcare facility, a hospital or surgical center that seemed like it was a bad outcome and might have been the result of a medical error, that this be reported to the Department of Health, and the facility initiate an attempt to try to figure out what caused this and try to keep it from happening again. Other things that have happened in recent years is in 1999 the legislature enacted a pilot project allowing health plans to be sold in the small employer market that didn't contain all the mandates. This was a pilot project. It was set up for 3 years and it expired without any products like that ever being sold. And this was the result of a dispute over whether it would be legal in Minnesota for employers to offer health plans where the employer is fewer than 15 employees that doesn't cover maternity benefits. And because of that dispute over one mandate, no such reduced mandate plans were offered, and that law is now expired. Another thing we've seen recently, and this was just last session, was the first repeal of a mandated benefit, and that was the repeal of the mandate for coverage of autologous bone marrow transplants, which are procedure done sometimes in connection with breast cancer treatment. I'll also mention that in 2004, the legislature dealt with health savings accounts, and Scott Leitz is going to be talking more about those consumer-driven plans, but I'll just mention that the legislature did enact legislation eliminating possible barriers for health savings accounts and high-deductible health plans to be offered in Minnesota. One piece that wasn't enacted was the favorable tax treatment under state income tax law that exists in the federal law. So I'm gonna stop there and just repeat my theme that I think it's very difficult to deal with healthcare cost containment. It's a very difficult thing to do, and the legislature has had minimal success in really making an impact on it.
Well, thank you. With those encouraging words, I'll thank you for coming. we're not going to do too many questions, but Fran, if you want to ask a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for clarification's sake, and I realize you're kind of doing a quick tour, but last year there were quite a number of additional elements that were passed that sort of encouraged evidence-based practices, disease management, things like deeming for hospitals so we don't have to have dual qualifications, something like a modest thing like being able to email reports if the consumer is okay with it. So actually they're pretty extensive, and I think the report that you receive, for example, is one of the extensions of what was passed last year.
So, and if there are questions for Mr. Pender, he'll be around a lot of these meetings, and he's also available frequently. So Mr. Leitz, want to come down? I think you have some math for us this time, don't you? Welcome, Mr. Leitz.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Scott Leitz. I'm the director of the Health Economics Program at the Minnesota Department of Health. Today, we're going to be giving you an overview of where we're at with regards to healthcare costs, as well as some information with regards to some of the private sector initiatives that are going on that are looking at how to contain healthcare costs. We're going to sort of divide the presentation up into two pieces. Julie Sonier, who's the assistant director at the Health Economics Program, will present information on kind of the status of healthcare costs in Minnesota, how fast costs are growing, and so forth, and then I'll cover some of the initiatives. And with that, I'll turn it over to Julie.
Thanks. We wanted to start out today by just pointing out that there are a lot of different ways of thinking about the causes of rising healthcare spending, and there's a lot of different levels of detail that you can look at the problem with. And the first chart in your handout basically shows an illustration of sort of the different levels at which you can think about this issue. What I'm going to do today is give a very brief overview of what we know about healthcare spending in Minnesota, where the money comes from and where it goes, and some of the recent trends. And Mr. Leitz will get into more detail with regard to specific, more detailed cost drivers and strategies for cost containment. At a very aggregate level, Minnesota spent about $22.8 billion on healthcare in 2002, which is the most recent year for which we currently have an estimate. This represents just under 12% of the state's economy. 42% of those funds, which is the gray shaded portion of the chart, came from government sources, and the other 58% came from private sources, mainly private health insurance and consumer out-of-pocket spending for deductibles, copayments, and services not covered by insurance, including services like nursing home care. Focusing in just briefly on the 42% of total spending that comes from public sources, about two-thirds of that comes from the federal government, which finances, of course, all of the Medicare program and about half of the state's Medicaid spending. Most of the remaining one-third of the public spending comes from the state. Because public insurance programs tend to cover populations that are at higher risk of needing health care services, like the elderly and disabled, public spending on health care is disproportionately large compared to the share of the population that's covered by these programs. So while public programs cover about a quarter of Minnesota's residents, they represent 42% of total health care spending in the state. The next slide in your handout is basically just a more detailed way of saying the same thing, so I think I will skip over that one in the interest of time and just leave it for reference purposes. I want to also spend a minute talking about where all of the healthcare, where that $22.8 billion is spent. According to our estimates, which we create from a variety of different data sources, the largest categories of spending are hospital and physician services with 28% and 22% of total spending, respectively. In recent years, prescription drug spending has been the fastest growing service category, and its share of the total has risen to about 12% from about 6 or 7% in the late 1990s. This next chart looks at healthcare spending growth in Minnesota in terms of some of the underlying factors that are driving the growth. And again, we'll get into those in more detail later on. Many of the things that are driving growth we can't observe directly, but two things that we can look at relatively easily are the effect of population growth and inflation. Population growth accounts for about 1% rise in spending each year, and inflation about 1.5% to 2.5% in recent years. The rest, and this is a pretty big chunk of the total spending growth in some years, is due to what we're very helpfully labeling other factors. Things like increasing use of services, new technology, and price increases that are over and above the level of general inflation.
Yeah, just if we cannot take questions now, if you can just bear it, we have you weren't here when I talked about that. We have a lot of content to go through, and we could spend the entire hour on this set of handouts. We want to get through this in about 20 minutes, and we want to hear from the evidence-based report and also the e-technology. When we finish all that, it will take questions the time we have left, and these folks are around to come back whenever we want them back, if that's okay. Do you want to ask it now, and then you can get that out of your mind, but the rest of the members, just write them down, and we'll... Representative Goodman.
My only comment right now is that this is probably the most important information we're going to have before this committee in making decisions about cost containment. So it's going kind of fast, and I'd like to understand it a little better.
We're at all levels of understanding of this material. And for some, this is the ninth time they've heard it. For some, it's the first time. Just given what we have to get through today, we have some people who can't come back that are going to unveil their report. We'll make sure you understand this stuff. So do you want to ask a question? I don't want to leave you out. Okay, well, let's move on then. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We are, of course, willing to come back and explore these issues in more detail at any time. But we are trying to go pretty rapidly today, given the limited amount of time. So with that overview of the big picture with regard to healthcare spending in Minnesota, I want to spend just a couple of minutes focusing specifically on private market trends because I understand that those are the main focus of this committee's work. In private health insurance, premiums tend to follow a cycle of being higher than underlying spending growth in some years and lower than underlying spending growth in other years. And that cycle is illustrated by this chart, which shows that in the mid-1990s in Minnesota, premium growth, which is represented by the blue bars in the chart, was very low. In fact, it was not high enough to keep pace in the growth with the health plan's expenses per person, which are represented by the gray bars in the chart. Starting in about 1998, premium growth did begin to accelerate, and this was in part to make up for past losses. But unfortunately, we also saw a big increase in underlying spending growth that started around the same time. So although premium increases in 2003 were the lowest in 5 years, we've now seen 4 years in a row of double-digit spending increases. And again, those are the gray bars in the chart. And unless we see a slowdown in the rate of growth of underlying spending, it's likely that premium increases would continue to be at or near double-digit rates in the near future. In this chart, we take a look at that growth in underlying costs and compare it to some other key economic indicators for Minnesota. For the last several years, healthcare cost growth, and by that I'm referring to the cost per person that's paid for by private health insurance, so it doesn't include enrollees' out-of-pocket costs, for example. The cost growth has been at a level 3 to 5 times higher than inflation, growth in workers' wages, or growth in per capita income in the state. So who's paying for all this rapid cost growth?
Did you say it does or doesn't?
Representative Thiessen goes to the chair.
Mr. Chair, I can hear
you. Just repeat what you said, please.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, that last chart does not include enrollee out-of-pocket costs.
Sorry.
Yeah, no, you have to clarify. I'm not trying to shut down discussion, but I just want to get this intro and make sure we cover other things. So if you didn't hear something, by all means, clarify that particular point. Thank you.
With regard to the question of who's bearing the burden of all of this rapid cost growth, both employer and employee contributions to health insurance have risen substantially in recent years. It is important to note, however, that in terms of percentage contributions, employer and employee shares have been stable. On average, employers contribute about 82% of the premium for single coverage and two-thirds of the premium for family coverage, and that's a relationship that has been stable over the last 10 years. In addition to rising contributions to their health insurance premiums, employees are also paying more out-of-pocket expenses in the form of deductibles, co-payments, and co-insurance. This chart does include those enrollee out-of-pocket costs, and what it shows is that in 1997, the out-of-pocket cost paid directly by enrollees of people who had private health insurance was about $152 per person, or 9% of the total cost. By 2003, the enrollee out-of-pocket cost had more than doubled to about $382 per person, or nearly 12% of the total cost. Finally, I want to share our analysis of which healthcare services are driving the cost increases in the private market. Although drugs do continue to be the fastest growing category of spending, and the blue bars in this chart show the growth rates for various services, the drugs are responsible for only about one-fifth of the total spending growth, and the share of spending growth is represented by the gray bars in the chart that you see up on the screen right now. Physician and hospital services are the biggest cost drivers, mainly because they represent the largest shares of spending to start with. Each of these categories accounts for about one-third of the overall spending growth. The next part of our presentation is a more in-depth look at the healthcare cost drivers and strategies for cost containment, and that Mr. Leitz will do that part of the presentation.
The first chart I'm going to show you is actually one from the Journal of Health Affairs, and what the title of this chart was, when it came out in the journal, "The Sad History of Healthcare Cost Containment as Told in One Chart," because what the chart shows is that there have been periods of time when we've tried certain things either at a state or national level that have managed to restrain healthcare costs, things like the imposition of Medicare and Medicaid, wage and price controls, the voluntary effort in the 80s, and then managed care, and the threat of health reform in the 1990s, which did bring down temporarily healthcare spending, but nothing that has been maintainable over any period of time. Another thing to keep in mind as a key piece of background information when thinking about healthcare cost containment, particularly on the private sector side, is that healthcare spending has a highly skewed distribution. That is, a relatively small share of the population accounts for most healthcare spending. The way to interpret this chart would be that on the left-hand side, 1% of the population, the most costly 1%, spends about 27% of our healthcare resources. On average, that 1% that spends 27% spends over $50,000 annually on healthcare, which is well above any deductible levels for insurance coverage, meaning most of that is all covered services. And so we need to keep in mind that there is a highly chronically ill portion of the population that spends a lot of healthcare services when we think about ways to restrain healthcare spending. I want to talk briefly about some of the factors that are contributing to healthcare cost growth in Minnesota. And I've listed a few here, and I'll just briefly talk about each of them. Technology investment. Most health economists believe that between 50 and 70% of healthcare cost growth over the last 40 years is due to technology. Now, the trade-off here, of course, is that technology has certainly likely increased costs over time, but it's also brought amazing advances with regards to patient outcomes. Things can be done much more rapidly, much more effectively, and much more efficiently in inpatient and outpatient settings, but it's come at a cost. So there's merely a trade-off there that we've decided to have in the medical economy. The second area is with regards to investment. We certainly see rapid advancement and building of things things such as imaging equipment, a variety of outpatient centers, and so forth that have rapidly advanced. Again, bringing increases in patient outcome, likely increases in patient access, but likely at some cost. So there have been some things, as Mr. Pender mentioned in his overview, this issue of investment and the fact that as we invest in something such as healthcare, that does tend to get used, and it likely does drive up costs. Again, the trade-off being that people are able to access those services more quickly. Issues such as lifestyle and behavior, for example, the increase in obesity. We've seen a doubling of obesity over the past 20 years amongst adults, and a doubling or tripling amongst children. And obesity is linked to many chronic conditions, and that's likely has had an effect in increasing healthcare costs in Minnesota. We've certainly seen that consumers have spoken with regards to their preference for broad provider networks with relatively limited access on relatively few access restrictions, meaning that the the tightly managed managed care that Mr. Pender spoke about has really been replaced with much broader provider networks, which have brought greater access certainly to consumers in terms of being able to see providers that they wish to see. That's likely also increased some utilization as well as some of the price of the goods that we, the healthcare goods that are consumed, and likely has been a factor in leading to some of the increased cost growth that we've seen. Things such as labor markets, the tight nursing market, for example, has led to wages for nurses, for example, being higher than they had been in the past, because healthcare is a relatively high cost, labor intensive industry. That's likely translated into somewhat higher prices. Market structure and things such as consolidation at the health plan and provider levels, both hospital and physician levels, has likely also had an influence. Demographics. We are an aging population. To date, that probably hasn't had a huge impact on our healthcare cost growth. The aging has been probably relatively limited. The baby boom generation, for example, is not into the real high use area yet. In the next 20 years, that's likely to become an increasingly larger portion of our healthcare cost growth. And then, as always, there's other factors that aren't listed here that have likely had an influence as well, things such as genetics and other things that we don't really have a control over. When thinking about healthcare spending and healthcare cost growth, there's a number of possible approaches that one can use. Ultimately, how much we spend on healthcare is a function of the price of healthcare that we buy and the quantity of healthcare that we consume. And so approaches that sort of, way to sort of think about this is obviously that we can look at approaches that reduce or contain the growth of the price of healthcare, reduce or contain the growth of the quantity of healthcare, the use of services that we have, or we can focus on the spending side and ways to buy smarter. That is to say, to focus on the quality and value of healthcare that we consume. And there's obviously different approaches that can be taken. Some are more market-based approaches. Some can be more regulatory approaches. I'm going to talk about a few of those approaches that are being either talked about, have been tried, or are being considered. There are a number of approaches that really focus more on the price of the good. The first two listed really focus on the price of health insurance coverage. Mr. Pender talked about the mandate-free or reduced mandate insurance plans that have been talked about. Where the goal here is to lower the price of the premium for businesses and for consumers to get it down to an affordable level. Because mandates are sort of built in, that may be only a one-time savings, but it may be sufficient enough, some believe, to actually induce certain people to buy into coverage who may not otherwise be buying right now. Things such as limited benefit plans that attempt to lower premiums by restricting the benefits covered, and that might be can take any number of forms, but again, the main goal here would be to lower the price of premium such that you might be able to get additional people covered who might not otherwise be covered. The issue here with limited benefit plans is depending on what is covered or not covered, there may be future costs if certain things aren't covered and care is delayed. Tiered networks are quite common throughout most private health insurance coverage. It's certainly very common in prescription drug coverage, where we might pay less for a generic but more for a brand name drug. But it's starting to grow beyond prescription drugs and into areas such as hospitals and other types of providers, where plans might be looking to negotiate lower prices with certain providers and then attempt to steer patients to those lower price providers by tiering the amount that they would pay out of pocket, depending on who they choose. Mr. Pender talked about medical malpractice reform and the potential to lower the cost of providing services, and that's certainly been talked about both here in Minnesota and nationally as an area that focuses on attempting to lower the price of healthcare. And then on the more regulatory side, limiting premium increases, Mr. Pender also talked about that. That can be done either voluntarily. The state of Maine right now is sort of in a mode of voluntary price containment, where they've asked hospitals and health plans to voluntarily limit the growth in their costs, or through more regulatory means. There are also a variety of approaches that focus on the quantity of healthcare that we consume. Consumer-driven health plans are talked about a lot now, and really the elements of consumer-driven health plans, which include health savings accounts, include a high deductible health plan, which is generally combined with a health account of some sort. Under health savings accounts, it would be an account that's portable by individuals, it's owned by the individual, and is tax-free. and some sort of internet-based decision support tool so that patients, as they access care, have some access to information as well. The real goal here is to make consumer to provide consumer incentives for more wise use of healthcare services, and there, and the hope is that there's some potential for savings for services funded out of that health savings account. And also, if the account-based healthcare that we consume really fundamentally changes the way that we access care, that is more of a fundamental mindset change of insurance coverage now that we have that account and we feel we're spending our own money, will there be a change in actually the way that we choose to access care? One thing to keep in mind with HSAs and consumer-driven health plans, of course, is that we still do have the skewed distribution of spending. And so while things underneath the deductible would be subject to the account, and we might think more about how to spend our dollars if they're in an account and our own dollars that are portable, most of the spending is still going to be above that deductible level, meaning we still need to think about approaches that really do address those high-cost cases. Another area where the private sector is looking is changes to benefit sets. And in general, that's taken the form of increased cost sharing at the point of service. The hope that as if consumers need to bear a little bit more of the cost at the point of service, they may consume less of things that aren't necessary, that are more things that aren't necessarily necessary care. The RAND health insurance experiments from the 1970s did show that as consumer cost sharing increased, people did reduce the amount of care that they consumed. And then on the more regulatory side, there are certain approaches that control investments, such as certificate of need programs or the hospital moratorium here in Minnesota, that attempt to control the quantity of services by reducing the supply of those services that are available in the market. And then there's a variety of approaches that focus on value and quality. The literature, the economic literature and health services literature really shows widespread evidence of what Mark Chasen calls overuse, underuse, and misuse of healthcare services. A few examples, and many of you have probably heard these examples before, but 50% of adults in the United States do not get recommended care, the care recommended for them. Recent data from the New England Journal of Medicine showed that Medicare spending in high spending areas, 60% higher than low spending areas like Minnesota, and there really aren't any differences between those high and low spending areas in quality of care, access to care, survival, or health outcomes. And then finally, many of you are likely aware of the IOM work on patient safety and medical errors, which documented misuse of healthcare services. There are a variety of approaches that have been taken to sort of focus on this value and quality aspect. Disease management is one area that has become quite popular with private health plans and also to some degree in public health insurance programs. Really what this focuses on, again, thinking back to that skewed distribution of healthcare spending, those chronically ill individuals who have very high health needs, a focused effort to really manage their condition so that they can keep that condition under control and keep healthcare costs low. There's a factor sort of limiting that strategy, which is it's a long-term strategy. You don't get necessary turnaround from disease management within the first 3 months, 6 months, or even a year. It's a longer-term strategy, and as people move from job to job or from insurance company to insurance company, the employer who may have invested initially in that disease management program may not necessarily bear the benefits of a more productive worker because that worker may have moved to additional another job. And so it's a long time to pay off, and sometimes it's difficult to capture that benefit. And so the business case for this is challenging and may tend to limit its use, but many believe that it's a promising area. A second area is Centers for Excellence, or what are called best-in-class providers. And really the focus here is identifying providers who have demonstrated high quality of care and then encouraging patients to use those providers. There's certainly been a number of attempts ongoing and are likely to continue in the area of pay for performance. And again, this is linked to attempting to create incentives that reward quality and cost-effective care. I've listed some examples from other states around initiatives that are looking at pay for performance. This is likely to be a growing area as healthcare dollars continue to grow and resources continue to shrink. And then finally, I put a mention here of the Smart Buy Alliance that was recently announced by the governor as in partnership with the private sector that's going to be focusing on those best-in-class providers, the adoption of modern information technology, more widespread consumer information, the adoption of uniform measures and quality and results, which is really a private sector focus on how do we get the best value for the dollars that we're spending in healthcare. Finally, Mr. Pender talked a little bit about this. These really represent initiatives that have either been initiated by the legislature or at the departmental level, and really focus on things that I know you're going to be hearing a lot more about today and, or saw about in today's newspaper. Adverse events reporting, which was covered quite broadly, that really focuses on improving safety and quality at Minnesota's hospitals and at other providers as well. Electronic health records, which I know you'll be hearing more about today. The use of evidence-based healthcare guidelines, which you'll be hearing more about today. And then information for consumers that focuses on cost and quality. A couple of initiatives just worth mentioning here in Minnesota. MinnesotaHealthInfo.org, which was a byproduct of the Citizens Task Force and was adopted by the Governor Plenty's Health Cabinet. And the Community Measurement Initiative, which is a health plan initiative at MNHealthCare.org, which attempts to get information on provider quality. So in conclusion, cost containment efforts can obviously focus on prices or quantity or combination of those two or on the value of what we're buying. There's obviously a tension that exists and has continued to exist over time between regulatory and competitive or market-based mechanisms. As the first chart I showed you, past efforts at controlling costs have had short-term but unsustainable effects. We tried those things in Minnesota with similar results to what we saw nationally. And then more recent private sector efforts are really focused on ensuring the value of healthcare that we're purchasing, an increased role for the healthcare consumer, and then efforts to provide information both to providers and to consumers as they access care. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And you all can, today is actually Biker Day at the Capitol, too, so that was kind of a fast ride on a fast Harley about through all this stuff. Well, I do commend you, Mr. Lights, for the information here. And members, I encourage you to go home. There'll be some homework out of this committee. We'll just be meeting about once a week to accomplish this really important task. The second time through, this will, just a second, will it'll make a bit more sense. Scott and Julie are available at a phone call away to handle some more details. And if we need to have them review some of these more fine points, we can certainly do that at a future meeting. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You said about it once a week. Is there any rhyme or reason to our schedule? Is it once a week, or how are we going to plan ahead?
Well, I can tell you what I'm thinking. I was just going to mm-hmm. say that. So thank you mm-hmm. for that lead-in. See, we're all getting along here.
Yeah.
The best time I can think of, since the Health Committee has a very large task on its hands during the normal meeting time, which is this time today, which we were allowed to meet, which is nice of a kickoff during the daylight hours, is that I think that Tuesday and Wednesday afternoons make the most sense at the 4:30 hour. And that would be humane for people getting home at some reasonable time. What I'm projecting now, and it's still a little soft, is that we meet next Tuesday at 4:30 till about 6. And I'm hoping that we can get some of the governor's crew to come in and tell them about this smart buy thing with maybe with Mr. Ludeman and whoever else they want to send. And there'll be some time for discussion then, I hope. And we'll try to make sure that each meeting is not just a beta come and spin the wheels and do the same thing we did last time. Many committees, you hear the report you heard last year. We'll try to keep it meaty, not too meaty so we can't really get our work done, but we have quite a project to undertake. In the future 2 weeks after that, February 2nd and February 9th, these are penciled in as times to meet at 4:30 till about 6:30. And I invited some senators to come as well. There is a desire to make this a bicameral effort. The joint committee idea has great merit, and I think that the time is too short to put it together. And so at least we're on our own. We're going to reach out across there, and they're very open. Senator Berglund, Senator Lori, Senator Cascaden, Dallas Sams, and others are interested in tackling this problem as well. And at the end of the day, we can do it in conference committee with two very different bills, or we can talk about it here and try to lead the effort. And never mind the coincidence that February 2nd, our first joint Senate House meeting on this topic that's so hard to fix is Groundhog Day. That's not meant to be any kind of an omen for how that might be, here we go again sort of thing. And people tend to leave, just 1 second, people tend to leave lobbyists of other places to go too, so I'm going to announce, I think we're done with you, so thank you. Get out of here now. And Commissioner Stang, you can bring your group up if you'd like. The folks in the audience, I need your participation as well as the people who you rub shoulders with. We truly need the ideas you would bring forward.
Many of you sat in your offices or represent people who have offices who say, why don't they do this? Well, you better tell us what you're wishing we were going to do because we need your ideas. If we merely come up with a rehash of what's been done in those two other good presentations we've had, we will accomplish the same outcome, which is this jagged effect. And maybe that's all we can do. If that's the case, well, then so be it, and we'll just pay the price. However, if we can find ways to engage the great minds of our state and the CEOs and the all the way down to the mail staff, then we can accomplish something. And my desire for the February 2nd and 9th meetings is so that individuals who have ideas that they want to bring forward about how to, what they would do if they were in charge, to bring forward those ideas. Representative Huntley, I have to say I don't like single payer all that well, but we should hear about single payer just to maybe we can graph something out of that to show that we're open to any idea that would come forward. And I think if we have an open mind about this, then people are willing to come forward and share their ideas, some of which will be impossible to do, some will be too expensive to do, but we'll capture some ideas that will be of value. And I hope that as members go forward on their own, that they can engage in their own meetings with their home districts and their own business and labor leaders, plans and providers. And if you want to set up a little working group, you know, we can set up a little working group that you want to head up on a topic, then we'll tell people you're in charge of looking into that topic. But we have to keep it broad. And if we're going to be successful and inclusive as well. So that's my in-the-middle talk. Representative Goodman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if we're going to have a report from the Citizens Task Force on cost health cost containment that the governor put together a while back. I understand that they did an extensive report. The governor evidently didn't like the end results, so we haven't heard much more about it, but I think it would be very important for this committee to hear what they had to say, since that was headed by former Senator Durenberger, and he's worked in the health care field for as far as on issues of health care for many, many years, so I would really like to hear what they came up with.
Yeah, Nipson Goodwin, that was presented here last year. We had, a whole session on that, and if they want to come, it actually would be helpful to read their conclusions. They weren't very specific. They had some good themes. We can build off of some of those themes, and I think that we want to include all the work that's gone forward, including that. And I think the report, maybe we should get that report available. Let's get it out to the members, because they did have quite a lengthy report. And if it would benefit people, we'll invite all comers to come. We are open to everything. Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to make sure we're all operating on facts, the governor fully embraced that report, and as a matter of fact, had Senator Durenberger very much involved with some of the initiatives and that the administration did. So there's no inconsistency. I think the chair is correct. If you read the report carefully, it's pretty vague in terms of its recommendations, but there was no disconnect between the governor's office and that report.
So anyway, if we're all on the same page, and so back to, I appreciate all that, and to the audience and to members who are going to invite people to come forward with ideas, please contact my office with, if you have a written version of your ideas, that would help. If you want to meet with me, I'll meet with you till whatever time it takes to get the meeting in. But it's a call to all of you in the audience, and I commend you for all coming. I really appreciate that, as well as whoever would hear about this meeting, because we need to get the best ideas brought out. And we will get something done then. I'm optimistic about doing the impossible. Commissioner Stang, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Doug Stang, Department of Health. To the points you raised, Mr. Chair, the Health Department, as you've seen already today's hearing, we've been very involved in this topic and can offer a great deal of information to you as you move through trying to tackle this very challenging issue. Last session, as you know, the legislature charged us with the task of doing several different reports. You probably, if you read the paper today, you saw the biggest headlines on the adverse events report that was just released yesterday. Today you're going to hear about a couple other ones. The one that is in front of you right now is the recommendations on systems improvements to advance evidence-based healthcare. This provides an update on the implementation of current and ongoing activities in the areas of evidence-based healthcare guidelines. The work of a distinguished panel of health experts who serve as a project ad hoc steering committee is the first phase of an effort to improve the quality of health care in Minnesota. The ad hoc group's charge was to advise the governor's health care cabinet on how to best meet the mandate of the legislature. On behalf of the steering committee, we have asked the co-chairs, Dr. Mac Baird and Ms. Patsy Riley, to provide you with a brief overview of this report. Dr. Mac Baird is a professor and head of the Department of Family Medicine and Community Health at the University of Minnesota Medical Twin Cities campus. His 25 years of practice and administrative experience have been focused on improving practices and creating improved clinical outcomes. Ms. Patsy Riley is currently president and CEO of Stratus Health, the quality improvement organization for the state of Minnesota. She has over 20 years of professional experience in health and human services, concentrated in the area of government government programs, including Medicare and Medicaid, and has been a valuable partner to many of the MDH activities. They've worked with some very qualified staff that we have employed within MDH as well to finish these reports. So we thank them for their work and taking the time out of their busy schedules to present to you the report today.
Thanks. So please come forward. And members, we had 20 minutes to go over this. Come sit down, please. And this could be a four-hour discussion. I sat with the department for 45 minutes talking about one page. And so I urge you to listen carefully to these experts come talk about this. Write your questions down. I'm sure they'll take your calls. The Department of Health will come talk to you. Read the report for yourself thoroughly at home, and you'll find it to be a good work in progress, I think you'll tell us. Welcome, Dr. Baird and Ms. Riley.
Thank you. Thanks to the committee and
whatever order you
chair, and we'll do a brief presentation here. The full report is before you, I think, for everyone now. And this did take the committee some time to come to. We're summarizing it from the summary that you have, so this will be very sort of brief. As you've heard earlier today, there is a lot of effort in Minnesota, a widespread long-term effort to improve care and manage healthcare professionals' education and productive delivery of care over many years. There is still evidence both locally and nationally that there's a significant difference between what we know how to do and what is best and what is actually delivered. This is not a simple thing to solve any more than the cost equation is. We're building on efforts that have already been started for many years, and this report is a summary of the committee's discussions and discoveries over the past several months. There is significant scientific evidence that there's a significant variation in care. It is sometimes influenced by local circumstances, patient choices, access to resources, and to some degree the ability to deliver what we know is the right care in the moment of care provision. This has been a national dilemma, and Minnesota has actually been leading the way in some cases of how to improve this. The variation is so complex sometimes because of the needed variation in the standard care plan based on patient choices and patient preferences about what color a medication is, let alone what cost it is. And that does influence some interactions. Also, there are cultural and other economic barriers to care and access to services that are needed to follow through on what we think is the right thing, but patients don't always have the ability to go through with that care. So given this widespread difference between what we know is best care, evidence-based care, and what is delivered, how do we approach that in a useful way? This report of yours that you have now recommends a series of linked strategies that promote timely access to and appropriate use of evidence-based healthcare guidelines in systems that are designed to continually improve outcomes for care, and this report is significant in that it could lead to continued reduction in disparities of healthcare services. There is an Institute of Medicine report that we use as a reference. It's called, you might be familiar with it, Crossing the Quality Chasm. There are six core attributes of excellent care that we have built upon. Those core attributes are safe care, care that's effective, patient-centered, timely, efficient, and equitable. In fact, Minnesota stands out in its efforts to achieve all of those aims. The principles addressed in those aims would be implemented if we were able to implement a more complete way the evidence-based care that we've outlined. Now, for the purposes of this report, we've defined evidence-based healthcare guideline as an evidence-based, meaning there's research behind it, statement of how to prevent or manage a particular symptom or disease for an individual patient under normal circumstances, taking into account the preferences of the patient and his or her family. There are a lot of caveats there. This is not cookbook medicine, and that's one of the things we sort of addressed fully in our committee. As you see, there are a number of recommendations outlined in the area that we have in the report. They include building systems for improvement, measuring and publicly reporting healthcare performance, align incentives and reward improvement, develop and ensure access to evidence-based guidelines both for consumers and professionals, and actually utilize government to facilitate and collaborate in the pursuit of the four strategies noted. We're going to just briefly talk about a couple of those recommendations. And the first one I'd like to focus on is building systems for improvement. We have been a leader in Minnesota in elimination of racial and ethnic barriers to health care. As you have heard briefly referenced, a national report that shows that Minnesota is one of those areas in the state where Medicare reports show that we have excellent quality and lower cost of care, at least for Medicare beneficiaries. There's a lot of work that's been going on. This legislature and other private foundations have been noted to help us in this effort. This report includes recognition of community health workers and others in the non-professional realm that have helped in this effort and are continually needed to improve care for specific chronic illnesses. As requested by the legislature, we reported on, in this report, several key issues such as diabetes, asthma, and cardiovascular disease. These are areas that are very common dilemmas and serious health problems that with a coordinated effort we believe we can improve. The recommended strategies are including a comprehensive approach that could leverage federal funding and facilitate use of evidence-based guidelines in multidisciplinary teams and would include everything from healthcare services delivered in clinics and hospitals to schools and other public resources. We believe state agencies can proactively assist in this effort as we've outlined in the report. I won't go through all of the implementation steps that we'd recommend, but it isn't focused entirely on just posting more guidelines. Minnesota is fortunate to have the Institute for Clinical Systems Improvement, ICSI as we call it, that's a national leader in implementing and digesting guidelines and processing them in a way that are applicable to the real world of practice in Minnesota. In fact, it's not the only source of guidelines, and we've listed them as appendices in the report. But it's really about systems of support to encourage use of evidence-based care. And without those systematic support structures, people, electronic systems you're going to hear about in a minute, and encouragement, both economic and other, it's hard to, in the moment of care, deliver the best care given patient influences and environmental factors. So we believe this combination of efforts can be helpful. Betsy?
Thank you, Mac. I'm going to talk a little bit about measuring and publicly reporting healthcare performance. And if you want to turn to page 11 in your report, that's where we talked about this particular focus for the that the committee had a great deal of discussion about. As Mac said, I think the committee overall stepped back at the beginning of our charge and said, you know, this isn't about just developing a yet another guideline. There's a lot of organizations that are developing and very skilled at developing guidelines. It's really about how do we build the capacity and the infrastructure within clinics, hospitals, health plans, et cetera, to be able to actually implement the guidelines. And that's a lot of the work that we at Stratus Health do on behalf of the Medicare population. It's a lot of the work that ICSI does working with clinics and hospitals is to try to build the capacity and build the support and understanding and the motivation for providers to actually adopt existing guidelines that have already gone through the evidence-based process that we describe in the report. I think there's a lot of lessons from Medicare that we can learn, which is the kind of the area that Stratus focuses in a lot, that Medicare some 10 years ago said that they wanted to start to have an informed, activated consumer. And to that end, they started to publish information on the Medicare website, www.medicare.gov, that is aimed at the consumer for the consumer to start to understand and be able to make comparisons on various health plans, end-stage renal disease facilities, hospitals now starting in March of 2005, clinics soon. They are already reporting on nursing home and home care agencies as well. So, and they're doing that at the agency or the provider-specific level. So I think there's a lot that we can learn from Medicare, and the state, I think, has been very effective as well in developing their own reporting, the reporting efforts. The Minnesota Nursing Home Report Card, the MDH website, yesterday, you should all be extremely proud of the coverage that the adverse health event reporting law that you all passed a couple of years ago, the coverage that was given. That is a nationwide groundbreaking initiative that you all had a very important part of, and you should be very proud of that effort. On page 12 of your report, we talked about aligning incentives and rewards for improvement. Scott mentioned some of that. I would describe the efforts here, both nationally and in our own state, as in its infancy, maybe in its toddlerhood, in terms of really being as effective as we could be in creating and aligning incentives to, and rewarding providers for improvements in care. At the Medicare level, Medicare created a demonstration project with hospitals trying to reward quality of care. That's in the process right now. There's several chronic care demonstrations that are going on. Here in Minnesota, we know that Health Partners, as one health plan, is rewarding its outstanding clinical efforts. Virus Healthcare Action Group and now the Smart Buy Alliance would also fit into this effort as well. Matt.
On page 8, if we want to go back to that, we recommended a way to develop and assure access for evidence-based guidelines. Rather than list more and more guidelines on specific medical topics, the committee spent a good deal of time outlining what are the criteria that should be met to support a guideline's widespread application. You see them listed 1 through 10, but they amount to very sensible ways to make sure things that are stated in a guideline are clear, they're applicable to the local environment, that the authorship is stated. In other words, it's important to know whether this guideline that one would look to is really a subtle sales technique for a pharmaceutical product or engineering device, or whether it's done on the basis of clinical research, not otherwise distorted. So then the authors need to represent all relevant fields, make sure that there's a developmental process that's stated explicitly, that the guideline is grounded in evidence, by which we mean more than one study to recommend its use, and probably in several different types of environments. That the evidence is cited and graded. We have ways of grading evidence now from what the sort of classic double-blind controlled crossover study where you know exactly what you're doing and whether it's clouded by the placebo effect, et cetera, or is it expert opinion, because we have none of those types of studies in that case. And then document that its use is flexible. There are times appropriately when a guideline is not appropriate for specific patients. Over a large group of patients, it should be applied most of the time, given normal population characteristics. But there are plenty of reasons why not every patient should be on a specific guideline treatment. And we have to make sure that measurements are there and are practical and are included in use to feed back to clinicians and teams of clinicians so they can learn and improve their care. And finally, there needs to be scheduled review and update. If a guideline, for example, this is one of the dilemmas about embedding it in law. If a guideline is created today, it is only a matter of months before we learn more on how it ought to be improved, or completely changed sometimes when we learn new things that you read about in the newspapers. So they have to be continually updated, and it leads us to be very shy about a specific recommendation on a specific topic and fixing it for very long. It has to be continually updated. So therefore, we would recommend these types of criteria to review any guideline. We listed three topics. The other two topics, depression and back care, could be included in a very parallel manner, but given the time frame we had, we decided to let that sort of rest, because we could go through a very similar process of vetting a guideline, and then you could name any topic on it. These three happen to be very common, very expensive, and a huge impact on the state of Minnesota.
Yep. If you want to go to page 12, then we also talked about the role of government. We had quite a bit of really spirited, I think, conversation about this at the committee level, talking about what government, the role of government, what they could do and maybe what they don't want to be doing to incent providers to be moving towards evidence-based healthcare guidelines and to try to close the what we refer to in the quality improvement business as the translation gap, the gap between when evidence is gathered around a particular practice and the time that it takes to have it fully embedded across all practices across the country is some alarming 17 years. So what we're trying to focus on is what is the role of government and many of the other sectors that we've talked about here, what is the role to try to shrink that translation gap, take it from 17 years, if we made it 10 years or 5 years, we would be making enormous progress. So if you go to page 12, You talked about how government can facilitate and collaborate in the pursuit of the four strategies that Mac and I have been talking about earlier. Continuing to address the high-cost, high-volume healthcare issues, which you have, congestive heart failure, diabetes, and asthma are extremely expensive chronic diseases. So by grabbing those topics, that's an important beginning step. To commit to rational purchasing strategies as agreed to in the Smart Buy Alliance, support efforts to develop more effective dissemination methods, ensure synergy between public and private sector efforts. When used as an example, the Community Measurement Project, ICSI, Stratus, and others that are working in the private sector, how can we leverage those efforts along with the work that's going on in the public sector as well? Developing small-scale demonstration projects, which could start looking at how do we incent providers, reward them for using phone, email, those kinds of things. Revising the enacting legislation, and we perhaps took the bold step to actually come back with some language that we suggest would actually make this this piece of legislation perhaps less of a lightning rod for using some terminology that the committee felt maybe isn't as expressive for what we're trying to do here. So in the appendix, we did attach some revised language for the bill. And then to avoid punitive endeavors aimed at rooting out and punishing individual bad actors. And again, I would applaud the efforts of the state around the adverse health reporting law, which was designed to do exactly that, was to move it away from pointing a finger of blame at an individual practitioner and moving it into trying to look at system improvement and system causes for the 27 never events that were talked about yesterday. And I think you can, again, be extremely proud of the amount of not only local coverage that this has received, but nationwide the amount of coverage this particular piece of legislation received. It had 6 columns in the Wall Street Journal today, which is amazing. So I really applaud your efforts in that regard. We also had just maybe one wrap-up, a recommendation for what government should not do, and that is to adopt as statute any specific evidence-based health care guidelines. As Mac had pointed out, it's a detriment to the ever-expanding body of knowledge and the ability to remain fluid in implementation. So we would really, really caution the legislature from saying the American Diabetes Guideline is what we're going to adopt or the ICSI guideline is what we're going to adopt, to really keep the emphasis on how do we build the infrastructure and the support for being able to implement guidelines, and that would be a better use of the legislature's efforts here is to figure out ways to incent that and reward providers for building those kinds of capacity within their clinics and their hospitals.
Mr. Chair, we recognize that this could be an all-day discussion on any one of these topics. We know there's an e-health discussion to follow. They're all connected, and we know that there might be lots of questions from lots of different people about this topic, but this is our abbreviated report on a brief report.
Thank you very much for coming. We do have about 9 minutes. Before you, I want to spend 15 minutes on e-health, and I have a comment, and then we'll take Rips and Huntley and whoever else.
Mr. Chairman,
you want to ask first? Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman and Ms. Riley, could you really briefly refresh my mind on the difference between Stratus and ICSI?
Yes, we get that question a lot. ICSI is a state-based organization funded by the health plans here in Minnesota, three major health plans, Health Partners, Medica, and Blue Cross and Blue Shield, and then UCARE and I believe MHP also are supporters.
And it costs money to join as a practice.
It costs money in terms of the time and energy and resources that the providers have to commit to be a member of ICSI. Stratus Health is the Minnesota Quality Improvement Organization. We hold the Medicare contract we have for 35 years to provide support, assistance, technical assistance, motivation, and resources for the Medicare population to improve the health outcomes on behalf of the federal government for Medicare beneficiaries in the state of Minnesota. And we've, again, using Medicare as an example, Medicare pulled out its checkbook some 10 years ago and said, what are the high-cost, high-volume clinical topics that we should be focusing on? Selected a lot of the same ones you see here, congestive heart failure, diabetes, mammography, breast cancer, et cetera, AMI, and said we need to start focusing our efforts on those things nationally. And what we've seen nationally is that over the last 6 years, we've actually seen very, very strong improvements, particularly here in Minnesota. We rank as one of the highest quality states in terms of Medicare's rankings in terms of improvement in those clinical topics. So we have a lot to be proud of in that regard.
Thank you, and I'm kind of glad that you're not interested in legislating or having us put in statute or any rule, because that would be the danger opportunity thing that would, you know, it's a good thing, bad thing. Can you maybe, and just I have a question I want you to take another tack for a second. So in terms of any practice guideline or evidence-based medicine or whatever the term is going to wind up being, and we'll probably discuss that here, I suppose, in terms of a guideline, you took the tack of saying, well, these guidelines are, this is a credible way to have a guideline, and so any guideline that would come along that would meet those criteria would be a guideline that you would say that, look at that one, look at this one, even though they don't match up as being identical guidelines, you would say they both have merit. That's the state of the art of medicine now, as well as the science, and that would be that's actually probably a kind of a positive conclusion to come up.
Yes, and I think you'd be amazed at how little difference there is between an ADA guideline, the American Diabetic Association guideline for diabetes, and ICSI's guideline. I mean, they basically, ICSI uses a process by which they select what they call a seed guideline. So they go out and they try to find the best guideline that already exists, and then they bring it into Minnesota, have Minnesota providers sit around a table and work with that guideline to, I describe it as Minnesotaizing it. But there's remarkable small changes that get made so that if a provider decided that the ADA guideline was something that they'd prefer to use, it would not be wildly different from the ICSI guideline. And Mac, maybe you can...
Well, and the difference is that this is vetted locally so that if there's a practical reason why a small point on the ADA or diabetic guideline might not be applicable or appropriate or realistic, this is now vetted by a lot of clinicians. In fact, I think 80% of the clinicians in the state are involved in ICSI one way or another. It would be applied more broadly with that kind of consensus. Otherwise, they could be very close.
Yeah.
One of the reporting differences that we're recommending here, by the way, is that we have consistent requirements for reporting, let's say outcomes or process measures. Mm-hmm. When there are slightly different ones from every payer and then a government, you have to build entirely different sort of systems to get those reports done. It's a very inefficient, administratively costly burden on practices now. In the community measurement project, help that because it solidified and coordinated reporting requirements so there is a unified one.
Thank you. Members of Epson-Tyson or I have a question then. Where do you go from here? I know there's you covered three topics. There's two more topics. It'd be easy just to say, well, use the same method and find a guideline that meets those criteria, and that would be that. Is there going to be more process than that on the next couple topics? And is your group now disbanded and gone over the health cabinet, or where do you go from here?
We might defer to the Department of Health for that, but our group felt...
Well, as far as you know.
As far as I know.
What they told you.
The group felt that we could easily plug guidelines into back pain and depression, but those areas are not as completely understood. I'm a member of several national committees on depression, not on back pain. I've been in them for 12 years. It's not that simple for those two conditions to know what you're calling for a diagnosis, what the outcome measurement is, what the proper treatment is. It's very complicated in those two areas. They're very important areas I'm committed to as a primary care physician, and especially depression. I'm trained as a family therapist, and I'm constantly trying to integrate mental health into primary care. But those two areas are exceedingly complex. Even knowing what the recommended intervention is controversial for both of them. So we would just soon not... Yeah. Exhaustively spend time on that as a committee.
So your task force is pretty well done. This is
correct.
Kind of the report, and you've done your work. Can you tell me, where do you think, so you have three now kind of approved lists of guidelines for three conditions. What's going to be the practical impact of that in the health world? Is that going to be used in a different way, or there now you just have given a little credence to those guidelines and people can, insurance companies use them better, or people will know to, indeed you can disseminate them and all that business, but in terms of, in those conditions, how will the system be different because of your work on those three conditions.
Patty and I might both want to respond, but if the legislature were to, for example, empower or encourage the state to use its purchasing power to do the things we've recommended, encourage rational care, guideline evidence-based care, by infrastructure supports and demonstration projects and other things we've listed in our recommendations, that could move what is already a moving, momentum-building enterprise. And if we could have a consistent thing like the Community Measurement Project did and have uniform outcome measurements and coordinate them among health plans so that if the state and the various health plans, let's say in diabetes, had consistent expectations and measurement of whether we're doing the job well or not, that would both save money on the practice of medicine but also drive everyone in the same direction. So we think the purchasing power would be a valuable asset.
And I guess I would just add, maybe I'll try to encapsulate some of the early conversation of our committee, and that was, again, merely creating or endorsing a guideline does not create the capacity or the motivation for a provider to adopt that guideline or to use that guideline or for a consumer to go and figure out what is the guideline. So we talked a lot about then what is the unique role that the legislature and the state could play to try to encourage the adoption of guidelines. And a lot of that was around building capacity, building infrastructure support. You're going to hear about e-health as one way, one tool of being able to support the implementation of guidelines. If a physician has at his or her fingertips the ability to call up a guideline for a person who's sitting in front of them who has not one but five chronic diseases, they may have asthma, congestive heart failure, diabetes, high blood pressure, and depression, and low back pain. If a provider has to have all of that knowledge in their brain, that's asking a lot. And so the ability to be able to call it up on an electronic health record and being able to get that kind of information rapidly and in real time, we think is a better use, and targeting that the limited amount of resources that we know the state and the legislature has at those in most need, the smaller clinics, the smaller hospitals in our state, that we think is perhaps a better use of time and resources.
Which is probably a good segue to our next topic, but I have one more question. Just to clarify this, so your final position on this guidelines business, which I've been in the middle of helping it to happen and with the same danger opportunity, fears above all do no harm, you know, we're here to help, you know. Probably the list of criteria you've set up will stand some test of time.
Yes.
The guidelines will not, and they oughtn't.
Right.
That's kind of the summary
exactly of
your work on. So, well, thank you for coming. We'll have you back again if people would like to hear more of your work, and I'm sure you're accessible if we need your advice.
Indeed.
So thank
Absolutely.
You very much.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Stang, you're going to introduce your next guest, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to quickly add to their comments that the healthcare cabinet is taking control of this issue as well. They will be continuing to look at this issue, but will be under their purview in the future.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, as you said, you know, these issues are topics that we can talk about for hours, and we enjoy talking about them. We're excited about these initiatives, adverse events, healthcare guidelines, and now e-health. Those are all initiatives that we believe will definitely impact the quality and the cost of healthcare into the future. And the legislature recognized that last session when it believed that expanding the use of health information technology, specifically electronic health records, should be a top health priority. We convened a group to provide recommendations and advice on how best to accelerate the progress in Minnesota. On behalf of the eHealth Steering Committee, we have asked Dr. Ray Gensinger, as a member of the committee and as a co-chair of the work group on finance, to provide you with a brief overview of this project. Dr. Gensinger is the Deputy Medical Director, Medical Informaticist at the Hennepin County Medical Center, and has been involved in the practical application of information technology in healthcare since his chief residency in internal medicine. He is also involved in the American Medical Informatics Association and now holds a first-year board director position for the Healthcare Information Management and Systems Society, serving as a liaison to their Electronic Health Record Committee. We also have Marty LaVenture, Director of Public Health Informatics for the Department of Health, and he also serves as a commissioner's designee on the steering committee. We appreciate their time, and I think you'll enjoy the comments that they have to make to you today.
Well, welcome to the committee. And when you, you can have the, you have 12 minutes to do whatever you'd like. When you, as you present for the first time, please state your name for the tape and.
I can give a report or do a clinic visit in 12 minutes. That's about
that. Fair enough.
Just very briefly.
Please state your name and then for the tape and then.
I'm Ray Gensinger. I'm the Deputy Medical Director for the Hennepin County Medical Center. And I appreciate the opportunity to present to you, Mr. Chairman, and to the rest of the committee on these preliminary recommendations for eHealth. I just want to quickly give you an example. I was in clinic yesterday. We saw 35 patients. My partner and I split those down the middle. Of the 17 or so that I saw, I had one patient who had come from another state seeking new care here, who had had considerable workup elsewhere, two patients who had had health care in other systems within Minnesota. None of those three had information available to me, and I had to start from scratch. And while in clinic, I received a phone call about a patient who had been receiving care at the medical center for the better part of 15 years, whose spouse had requested a transfer to a new nursing home, which was unaffiliated with the medical center and was going to require a transition of all of that information to yet a new provider for that new nursing home. These are examples of why being able to exchange information clinically is so critical to what we need to do here. Driving reminder. I'm going to just cover a couple of topics for discussion today, set a little bit of context for everyone, talk about the Minnesota roadmap, and then list the preliminary recommendations that we have. Clearly, the challenges in Minnesota are no different than they are in the rest of the country. We have high error rates, higher than we'd like them to be. Quality is inconsistent. That's not to say quality is bad, but quality varies, and we want to make sure that we have the highest standard of quality across our provider organizations. Costs are escalating, you've heard that. Research results are not rapidly used. We have guidelines. I have a packet of ICSI guidelines that I keep in my office. Unfortunately, the stack is quite thick. There are recommendations that come out from other organizations, and there's evidence that suggests that many providers may take between 5 and 10 years after a recommendation is made or a guideline is published before it becomes common practice. Clearly, the demographics is shifting in our population. Baby boomers are becoming our primary seekers of health care, and capacity continues to be a challenge. HHS Secretary Thompson made it very clear. We're working in the wrong century right now. We're in the 21st century, but our technology is one that was established back in the 19th century. Last year, the legislature had the wisdom to ask that a number of different initiatives be undertaken at the Department of Health. I feel very fortunate to have the opportunity to have served on the eHealth initiative over the course of the last 6 months. There are a number of different areas where we could focus for this initiative. There are four quadrants listed here before you. The focus initially is on the clinical EHR, the electronic health record, and in the public health sector, the Minnesota Public Health Information Network, concepts of how to spread the information around. These relate very closely to the National Health Information Infrastructure and David Brailer's group. David Brailer serves as the coordinator for health information technology nationally. What is the eHealth initiative? Right now, we are a public-private collaboration of members. There are, I believe, somewhere between 25 and 30 members who are actually on our committee. We have left it open. We have a number of interested parties and other contributors that probably number in the 50 to 100. Marty keeps the email list, and so we've been very excited about the contributions of others up to date. It is co-chaired by Mary Brainerd, the CEO of Health Partners, and Mary Wellick, the director of Olmsted County Public Health. We have representation from the MMA, health plans, long-term care facilities, large and small hospitals around the state, as well as provider organizations, and I believe some representatives of the patients themselves. We're trying to address the needs of many of these different stakeholders. Clearly, our purpose is to improve the health and healthcare quality for Minnesotans. And we're trying to do that through a number of different ways, mostly to accelerate the diffusion of knowledge and decision support to make complete records available to providers throughout the state of Minnesota. We're trying to increase patient safety. Clearly, information that's presented in the newspapers, as was yesterday, is embarrassing to the healthcare providers. We would like every case to turn out perfectly. We need help in taking each of these individual cases and making them more, provide more effective treatment and to have better outcomes for each of those individuals. We're trying to figure out how to provide better care and at the same time reduce costs in an environment. Many times it's perceived that better care is the involvement of more technology. Technology is associated with money. Money then creates an increased cost to the system. So there is data and suggestions that there's also a considerable amount of money to be saved through automating healthcare. Two different reports that were published, one last year, one that was reported on yesterday, suggested that at first the use of physician-provider order entry could save the nation as much as $75 billion a year once it's fully implemented. Yesterday, there was the discussion and presentation about fully integrated and interoperable electronic records, so that a record that I would use at the Hennepin County Medical Center would interact with what happens at the Mayo Clinic or another state, and that once that interoperability was fully implemented, that there may be an additional $75 billion a year, $150 billion a year, that could be saved across the nation. There's a lot of naysayers to that. Those reports use a lot of hypothetical analyses. But even if we could save 10% of that $150 billion, that would make it worthwhile. Clearly, we want to improve public health and the initiatives that we take on. Our approach is to provide statewide leadership for this endeavor. It would be very easy for individual organizations to try and do their own thing. We don't think that that is the most beneficial way to succeed at the state. We want to focus on consumers and on the continuity of care, not individual encounters with providers. We're trying to take time to identify and address all the barriers for the adoption of information technology. Within the Twin Cities, many of the large provider groups have in place different technologies to provide services, but we're not sure how well penetrated that technology is outside in the outer parts of the state. We're trying to look and find out what sorts of incentives we can use to foster further adoption. We're trying to spread the knowledge of best practices across the state as well. We're trying to leverage Minnesota resources that we have available. We're trying to create opportunities for more federal funding. We're trying to figure out how to involve more stakeholders, including for stakeholders that may have interest in contributing to the success of this financially. We want to make sure that we're focusing on small and medium-sized communities as well. A couple of things. It's important to understand what we're not trying to accomplish. It might easily be perceived that we're trying to build this giant database of healthcare information that sits somewhere outside of a provider's office. That is not the case. We're looking for a way to take information that exists within systems of providers and making that quickly and easily available to the providers. We're trying to do this in a way that we're continuing to strengthen privacy and data protection. That is, information is not passed unless the person requesting the information is authorized to request it and receive it, and that the information that is being requested has, in fact, been authorized for transmission. And we're continuing to look for efforts of support of private innovation. This is the list of official committee members. Like I said, there's probably 50 to 100 other major contributors to the work that has been done to date. The vision that we developed for the Minnesota eHealth is listed here. We're trying to improve healthcare quality, increase patient safety, reduce costs, and enable individuals and communities. And I think we threw in world hunger down there as well. We understand that this is a huge endeavor. The initial charge of the work group was to solve these problems and present back a report in this time frame. We have initial recommendations, but clearly the exciting part is that all of those members and other interested parties really have committed to continue to work on this endeavor until we come up with a solution that that is successful. Some more information about the vision on what we're hoping to accomplish here. We need to connect the healthcare providers. That's one of the first pieces. In that if we can't connect each of the individual providers, that creates gaps. If there's gaps in the information network, you can never really trust the information that's in front of you. We're trying to use national standards. We just responded to a request for information from the NHII looking at what kinds of standards the federal government could assist in developing that would help the state of Minnesota, other states, other regions in setting up infrastructures like this. We're trying to figure out how to empower consumers to make them involved in this as well. I'm not going to go through. You can read these yourself. They're pretty much all self-explanatory. This is where the money is for what we're hoping to accomplish, and hopefully each of you have a fairly large version of this. Pretty small on screen. I apologize for that. But the four large blocks that are identified as goals, those map directly to the Office of the National Coordinator on Health Information Technology, kind of the framework that they've set out. One is to inform clinical practice. Next is to interconnect clinicians, personalize care, and then to improve population and public health. I'm going to come back to the specific one through three goals listed under each of those. We go to the bottom, and you can see that we have cross-cutting or cornerstone initiatives that we need to establish, and that's where the emphasis of the work is going to be from the committee over the course of the next 6 months, and that we have to continue to analyze value for the investments that individuals are putting forth. We need to establish a governance structure for data sharing. If we're going to share information, there needs to be a way that we can reconcile a lot of the challenges that are going to be made in making sure that the information can be shared and how to agree on the data standards that are going to be done. I realize we're out of time. I'm going to move quickly. We're going to try and focus on three major initiatives under each of those major blocks over the course of the next 6 months. We have subcommittees on finance, governance, as well as on standards and architecture. They have all begun meeting this month and are probably going to be meeting on a biweekly basis through early April when we will present preliminary reports back to our larger work group. And then we hope to present a final presentation at a summit in mid-June. At that summit, we'd like to bring in some national leaders, including individuals like Dr. David Brailer, to speak, to talk about health information technology initiatives, and we would also like to present some of our answers to the key questions that we've laid out, and then we'll continue to provide a report back to the legislature. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to present today. There clearly is a critical need right now. There's also a readiness for change in many of the organizations, especially here in the Twin Cities and in the greater metro area. And we have great leadership and other opportunities for leadership, and we want to take advantage of that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Yenzi. Are members have any questions about this? They're not going to be back anytime soon, so if you want to ask a question, there's... this is a mammoth topic.
Correct.
If you pull it off well, you'll avoid the little picture I have for you here.
I have it on my wall in my office.
And so much of our work is like that. There's so many upsides and so many pitfalls along the way. I think you're asking a lot of the right questions. I mean, my concerns are in your list, so I'm glad you're working through. This report comes out in June.
We'll have a first report hopefully within a week or two on our preliminary work that has been done over the first 6 months, and then we'll provide a follow-up report later in June.
Well, I appreciate coming.
I'm available if anybody has follow-up questions that can be reached. Marty can get a hold of me in the Department of Health folks, and I'd be happy
to. Thank you very much. And members, we're going to be meeting, unless I let you know otherwise, at 4:30 on Tuesday, I suppose, back here. But there'll be an announcement about where it'll come, and we'll have some more information and some time to talk. So at this point, we're adjourned. Thank you.